and I'm on a in a tumuaki. Tenakoto, tenakoto, tenakoto kata. To do justice to my presentation on the New Zealand curriculum this afternoon, I have about a 5-hour presentation, so it could go well into the evening. John and his education heavyweights might want to come and unplug my computer and wrestle me off the stage at some point. Anyway, when we settle down, I'll settle into it. I'd like to say, just while people are finding their places, not everybody appreciates that this revised New Zealand curriculum is arguably one of the most liberal national curriculum statements in the Western developed world. And you might ask, how come New Zealand has such a document? I speak to many principals about it and they say, we're really excited about this document. It offers so many opportunities about what we believe, about educational process, learning and all those sorts of things. But not everybody shares that excitement, and you need to be mindful of that. For example, the briefing notes prepared by the Ministry of Education to the incoming minister, which is a sort of a 3-yearly ritual. How many people have read those, by the way? Okay, 2 or 3 people have read those briefing notes to the minister. In the many pages and the thousands of words of those briefing notes, about one line was devoted to the national curriculum. Now, that was a message about how this curriculum is perhaps regarded by some people who have perhaps the keys to policy making in this country, and we need to be mindful of that. Those briefing notes were mainly concerned with, guess it, literacy and numeracy, teacher performance, principal performance, contracts are coming up for renewal. Here are opportunities to help overcome our malady of underachievement in this country, particularly in literacy and numeracy. As a paranoia that has swept the Western world, and we're now part of it. Moreover, last week I attended a principals' conference in Queenstown, and I asked the Minister of Education at that conference, I said, look, we understand your drive for literacy and numeracy. We appreciate that they're fundamental to a good education. But can I perhaps get some appreciation of what your view of a good education for New Zealand's children is? Literacy and numeracy aside, but at the centre. What is your view on what constitutes a good education? We have the arts, we have health, physical education, we have science and so on. She sprung around and she said, it's literacy and numeracy, just like that. That bothers me that New Zealand could be going down that particular track. Congratulations on your first time principalship. So I was a principal in the last century. So, and I was very pleased that Richard Aiken, who's here today, a principal of a school, a first-time principal, came up and spoke to me because he said, you are the principal of the school that I attended as a junior. I have got a lot I want to cover this afternoon. And for those of you who have experienced my presentations before, you'll know that they can get very messy, very fast, that I have to skip slides and all those sorts of things because of my eye being on the clock. But I'm going to assume that you are very fast readers, so that what is on the screen, you'll absorb it while I'm talking and be ready to move on. It seems to me that there is a phaseology of the New Zealand curriculum. Phaseology? No such word, you might well say. I couldn't find it myself in the dictionary, but there is a place there for creativity. It seems to me that those phases of a curriculum that most schools are working their way through are whole, parts, and whole. The whole part is about what are the intentions of this curriculum? What are its directions? Moreover, what interests you as principals? What are our obligations as principals, as leaders of schools? Then many schools are engaging quite intensely in what I've called clarifications and explorations. What do, for example, what does science really mean in this curriculum? Notice I didn't say the key competencies, because that's where most people seem to have started. Where do values fit in? And then there's the stage where you've got to come back to at the end of all this exploration and clarification and putting it back into the whole in terms of its meaning for your school. The school I'm working with in Wellington has developed an umbrella, and they say this umbrella is what actually sits over our curriculum. It's quite a nice metaphor in a sense, in that they've got those dimensions of the values, the learning areas and the key competencies all held up by that pole that says the principles, and the top spike in their umbrella is their vision. So they've tried to bring all of this together in a pictorial sense. A connected curriculum, connecting the New Zealand curriculum with the school's curriculum, involves a number of things. Knowing and understanding what the purpose and the meaning of this curriculum is, knowing and understanding the factors that actually impact on curriculum, knowing and understanding what the direction of this revised curriculum is, because it's my view that the profession has not been really assisted greatly in understanding what that direction is all about, apart from being told it's a curriculum for the 21st century. You'd hardly be writing one for the 22nd century, would you? But then again, there are only 91 years left, so perhaps that might not be a bad idea. It involves knowledge and appropriate interpretation of the schools and teachers' mandatory obligations, what is required of us, and how these can be interpreted in ways that fit with the school's own beliefs and priorities. That is a legitimate part of what this curriculum is all about. It's actually finding yourself, finding your school in this curriculum. It's about knowledge and understanding of the intentions of different dimensions of the curriculum. What is actually meant by those key competencies? A lot of funny things are going on around New Zealand in the name of the key competencies. I was proud last week at a meeting of the Ministry's Advisory Committee on the implementation of the curriculum to hear from somebody that a school had pulled out of one of its development clusters because this development cluster was doing exploratory work in the assessment of the key competencies. The school pulled out because they said they'd been to a seminar led by Lester Flockton and no way were they going to pursue anything more to do with the assessment of the key competencies. I'll be proud of you if you follow the same train. Now, for a school to really take on the meaning of this, and I'm sure you've had a lot about leadership during these last day or so that you've had together, arguably, you need to be a learning organisation. If you've not got that, this is not really going to work for you. And Senge, in his book, The Fifth Discipline, how many people have read that as preparation for being a first-time principal? Right, there were about six hands went up. The rest of you, how many went along to the bookstore and tore this page out? Because that's all you really need, is this one page out of this book that sums up what it's about. He uses lovely, eloquent, lyrical language, which actually belies the complexity of what's intended in his messages. He says a learning organisation, and Senge is a Harvard management business guru whose influence has spread into all sectors, including education. He says it needs to be a place where people who continually expand their capacity to create the results they truly desire. First great challenge for a principal. What are the results we truly desire in our school? How well are these articulated in our school? Where new and expansive patterns of thinking are nurtured. Already, I have seen practices in schools, and all they are really doing is pouring old wine into new bottles in effect. They're just using the same old knitting patterns, but giving it different labels to suit this particular curriculum. Where collective aspiration is set free. You, as principals, have got the major influence and role in allowing that to happen. But what is that collective aspiration? What do we want? Is it a collective one, or is it a sort of amoebic one that is resident in some parts of the school but not others? Where people are continually learning how to learn together. And if there's something we know about learning theory and learning now, we know is that socio-cultural theories of learning are arguably the most powerful influence on learning for the millennium and the times that are ahead of us. Central to this whole notion of a revised curriculum is learners. I've not said students, unless, of course, you want to call yourself a student again, and there'll be nothing wrong with that. By learners, I'm not just talking about the students in our schools. I'm talking about everybody who's in the school. I'm talking about your board of trustees as well. We must all regard ourselves as learners. Now, for learners to actually be motivated to want to actually learn, those central considerations of interest, relevance, and engagement are absolutely fundamental. If you've not got those, the learning is not going to proceed to the levels that you'd aspire to. And if you can't pronounce this man's name, he himself advised you to say it's Chick Sent Me High. He says that the chief impediments to learning are not cognitive, not up here. It's not that students can't learn, it's that they may not wish to. And that is something that we don't fully understand in our practice at times. I mean, look at this little boy here. This boy wishes to. When I saw this child in the school in Taranaki, I thought, he's got all of Chick Sent Me High at work. And he's salivating over that picture he's drawing, isn't he? Do you ever salivate over your work you do? Okay, when you're preparing board reports, you salivate over it, you're totally engaged. We can actually conceptualise and we can make diagrams and so on. I love making diagrams till the cows come home. But this one here, the series that I'm going to build up, depicts the nature of this curriculum. In one sense, you've got, in one section of it, you've got the learning areas. And the other sections are the key competencies and the values. And for the learning areas, I regard these as learning for knowledge and skills. The other dimensions, I talk about learning for learning and living. Now, somehow, those two need to be brought together. And as James, Professor James says, the challenge for teachers and for schools is to focus on those two things simultaneously. Teaching the substance of the subjects and helping students to learn the ideas and practices associated with those processes. I mean, one way of depicting this is to look at the key dimensions of this curriculum. And here I've got the values, the key competencies in the learning areas, not in a particular order of priority, and along here the principles that apply to all of these. You could arguably treat each one separately. Monday mornings you do values of assembly. Friday afternoons you do thinking, because you want kids to generalise it into their lives. So you do it then so they'll do it in the weekend. Okay. You could treat them separately. I have been to schools in the North Island where they call themselves value schools and they do have special values curriculum. And it works very well too, some of the schools that I've observed on. But in actual fact, what we're trying to achieve with this curriculum is a more holistic approach. So let's change from those sort of solid state appearances to something like this. Now you can tell by looking at this, same things on it, learning areas, key competencies and so on. When I put these together, you'll immediately recognise that this is a child, a student, can't you? See the student there? Okay, now this is a learner, and the school's role in relation to curriculum is somehow to be having influences on the student's learning in relation to the learning areas, the exploration and understanding of values, and the development of those relational and cognitive key competencies. And your role in a school is to be developing learning experiences that will engage those students, so you're feeding into the student, so they're expanding their capacities in all of these areas. And each of these is windows through to the other. But it's not just you who's actually having inputs into the student's learning, it's also their experiences and lives. The other students in the school, in the classroom, their home, all those influences are going to be bearing in upon the student's capacity to expand their learning in these dimensions. So that is your role then, is in this curriculum, is to have this sort of concept, I guess, that these things are mirrors that actually, windows through to each other. As that rather vulgar North England woman who we used to bring over here ad nauseam to tell us how to do assessment, what's her name, Ruth Sutton, used to say, one of the flaws of this sort of model is that it overlooks the incontinence factor in students, the fact that they leak. So somehow in this model you need to try to close it up at that particular end so what goes in isn't coming out. This model of the interrelationship of the notions of substance and process is far from new, but it's still being depicted in many ways, and I quite like this depiction from Haynes and McDowell's work where they see it as a DNA, the interrelationships. In actual fact, of course, you're not going to have equal divisions around the English, the arts, and so on and so on and so on and so on. You as a school are going to have to make up your mind about the allocations, the priorities, how you're going to configure those dimensions of the curriculum. Sitting around curriculum, of course, are matters of leadership, learning, teaching pedagogy, curriculum, and assessment. These are all inseparable dimensions of a curriculum in action. And this afternoon I want to spend some time just briefly on some of those. Then around that, of course, we've also got matters of research, investigation, theory, supposition. For example, we've got a section in the curriculum on pedagogy, which actually takes a particular theoretical stance. That is, pedagogy is inquiry. That is only one theoretical position on pedagogy. There are other socio-cultural views of what pedagogy constitutes as well, but of course that's the one you've got in the curriculum. Then there's the whole matter of what we understand by learning in itself. If we don't have developed understandings of these different dimensions, our curriculum firepower is going to be all that much weaker. So, coming back to learners, a re-examination of the relationship between the teacher and the student in the learning process is required. I made this slide at the airport this afternoon. This is because the teacher-student relationship has a central mediating role, as does a complex interrelationship between teacher-student beliefs about learning. You can read the rest for yourself. Arguably, this is the sort of thinking that is sitting behind this curriculum. So we have to say, how do we move from more traditional ways of thinking about curriculum into ways that are more attuned to what we now fully understand about the nature of learning and learning process? I'd like to talk about each of these dimensions that sit around and impact and influence the curriculum for better or for worse. Policy, think politicians, think policing, think Education Review Office, all those things actually affect how curriculum is affected in the school. I only want to touch on one of them, although I'd happily spend the rest of the day talking about the others. And I could spend the rest of the day talking about the research side. The Ministry of Education commissioned the University of Waikato, another university in the North Island, to examine the effects, to do a meta-analysis, if you like, of the effects of curriculum assessment on pedagogical approaches. In other words, to look around the world to find out what research can tell us about curriculum. You've got the website there, which I've jotted down because you want to rush away and have a look at it. Here are some key messages from this very, very interesting study that Waikato did. There's a dearth, think death, of research evidence to understand the complexity of curriculum assessment and pedagogy and its influence on student achievement at the classroom level. I mean, the work of the late Professor Graham Nuttall certainly affirms this. He tried to do it. He found he couldn't. There's no firm research-based conclusions that can be given as to whether the curriculum should be mandated or open at the national level, or to what level of specificity learning outcomes should be defined. So a lot of assumptions sit behind curriculum design. I mean, I've got a view that, a theory if you like, a supposition, that if we actually did away with the national curriculum altogether, we could do an experiment. In the South Island, we don't have any national curriculum or any assessment of literacy and numeracy, and we do that for 10 years. We're just really great pedagogues. We give kids a great learning experience. In the North Island, you carry on deserving yourselves. And then 10 years down the track, we sort of then do some form of assessment to find out, you know, what is the sort of the relationship between those two? Is there some correlation? Now, my theory is that possibly the South Island might be outperforming the North Island. I know there are other demographic factors that would contribute to that, but never mind. There's no clear evidence that the existence or absence of a national curriculum leads to improved student performance. How does that make you feel? In fact, there is a Scandinavian country that does not have a national curriculum that is one of the highest performing countries on the international achievement surveys. It does have superior curriculum resources for teachers to draw upon. No matter what's included in the curriculum at a national level, it is the classroom curriculum that impacts on student achievement, and there are very few classroom studies to provide insights into this. But this is a great key for you to think about in terms of your role in curriculum. It's what goes on in the classroom that matters. So when I've done a few principals appraisals, and when I go to that, I say, yeah, you know, what would you like your principal? So we'd like to see the principal in the classrooms more often. And the principal says, oh, but you know, I've got a very busy job managing the school and so on. I'd like to go around them, and you know, it is virtuous and all those sorts of things, but I just can't get around them. That principal does not have, arguably, a strong understanding of the curriculum and practice in their school. All of their knowledge is secondary. Think about that. The types of assessment and reporting regimes that are put into place influence curriculum time on subjects. Think about what is lying ahead of us, particularly for the primary sector, with our literacy and numeracy testing and reporting. I asked a school a couple of weeks ago in Wellington what sort of time allocations they gave to different curriculum areas, and this basically was it. Over half of their time is devoted to literacy and numeracy. Whether you look at that as a week or a day. One writer in the UK referred to this situation as literacy and numeracy becoming the evil twins of the curriculum. Why? Because it's squashing out all of those other important areas of learning. When I mentioned the evil twins to the Minister of Education last week, she was horrified that anybody would think of such a term for literacy and numeracy. She thought it was, to quote her words, disgusting. Right. Well, there's some of the best advice you can really get anyway. When it comes to research, every professional needs to have, because researchers now have a major influence on policy in this country. They're very close to these, to our politicians and our policy makers. But we need to understand the true nature of research. Translating research into practice is not as straightforward as we might pretend. While research can tell us something useful about how to teach or how not to teach, it does so at a high level of abstraction. Furthermore, research tells us almost nothing about what to teach and why to teach it. This is because what and why aren't empirical questions. They are not research questions. They are normative or philosophic ones. Think hard about that when you can't sleep tonight because you've been overstimulated by all the things you've got to think about. Figuring out what counts. I'm going to read these because I believe in these statements quite passionately. There was an assumption that test scores will rise, disparities reduced for diverse learners, if teachers use research-based practices. Research shows that effective teachers adapt information from experts when they feel it's necessary. In one study, for example, highly effective teachers were distinguished from less effective teachers by their insistence on modifying researchers' recommendations when, in their judgment, the research findings did not quite fit their classroom situations. Now, I think that that is testimony to fundamental good pedagogical sense. I remember at a meeting once, John Hattie bemoaning the fact that teachers were fiddling around with Aspel, not doing as it should be, and hearing somebody reply to John and said, "But John, that's what teachers do. Get over it." Now just let's look at some of these dimensions that sit around. First of all, learning. Let's just brush up on what we actually know about learning. Learning is all of those sorts of things. It's diverse, it's different for each individual, it takes time, it takes longer for some of us than the rest of us, it's linear and it's erratic, it's messy, it happens by design, it happens by chance. And yet there are sort of beliefs that if we have the right methodology, all kids will be able to get up to the 90th percentile or beyond, or at least up to the national standards, whatever they may be. Roy Sadler, an Australian academic for whom I've got total admiration, he's a lovely man, he thinks some different ways about things, but he says for learning to have happened, three conditions have to apply. You have to be able to do something on demand that you couldn't do before. You must be able to do it independently of others. For example, if you're driving the car through Auckland you need to sort of know certain things about navigating your way through Auckland, and it can only be done through having other people in the car, you're going to be lost if the others aren't in the car at that particular time. You must be able to do it well. Anyway, as John Cleese says, if I learn something new, I go to bed happy. There's a nice message in that for all of us. Bear in mind this very simple graph when it comes to learning. The light shaded part of this pie shows the amount of waking hours that students actually have in school compared to the amount of waking hours that they have outside of school. And I believe that this should actually be flashed on television before the 6 o'clock news every night on every channel and every time before any policymaker or politician makes a statement about what schools have got to do next. John Hattie's studies, he claims that in his studies, his meta-analyses and so on, about 30% of what kids learn can be attributed to the school. Remaining 70%, and these aren't his words, they're mine, are attributed to, but he says in effect, to the home and to your natural assets. Because we've all got different cortical patterns up there. You probably have workshops to examine those being principles. Our synapses fire at different rates and so on. Do you realise that? Some of yours are firing quite well now, some of them are actually quite dull because it's this time of the day. If you read John Hattie's latest and controversial book, and in that book he says, I'm not going to actually take into account all those 70% things in effect as influences on learning because they're outside the control of the school. But those are the things that actually do impact on kids' learning. And when I said to the Minister of Education last week, I said quite a few things as you probably gathered, when I said to her, international research and one of your favourite academics says, gives us this data, there are major implications for variance in kids reaching national standards. And your systems are going to serially, as they say in England, serially, ritually punish the lower decile schools. Her response to me was, we're not going to have excuses. So who are the lower decile schools here? No excuses for you people. It is debated this figure, this research on how much effect the school actually has. It's a very difficult one to research. But another very credible study actually says about 20% of all learning can be attributed to what happens in the school and in the classroom. So when we read policies about strategies for Māori success, we don't get told those things, and I think the system is a little bit dishonest. The system has to say, hey, wait on, the school cannot be expected to do these things on its own. It will not happen on its own. It will only happen if children come from caring, nurturing, experience-giving families. We know that experience-giving families are variously advantaged or disadvantaged according to their socioeconomic status. Then bear in mind that in a typical class of 25 students, the teacher has about, I think it's about 12 minutes per student per day. And yet in some schools, high decile schools in particular, some parents think you've actually got for their child and the rest of the class has got the 12 minutes and my child's got that time. Fortunately, we don't operate a system where we say to children, I'm sorry dear, your time's up. Next person, please. We use various methods. Now let me move to teaching or pedagogy if you prefer, because it seems to become a preferred word, but I quite like the word teaching. Pedagogy is from the ancient Greek about a man leading a boy to school. We always had those sorts of jobs in the olden days. I think there are issues also about understanding the nature of pedagogy. I think that we're on the brink of becoming far too technical and rational and managerial in our view of what teaching is all about. I could not teach myself with passion in a system that is such. Somehow there needs to be a strong place for the intuitive, the expressive, the creative, for the inquiring mind that permeates the whole ethos of the classroom. As Mary James says again, the difficulty in the climates developed around the initial teacher training, not just initial teacher training, in the last 15 years has been the reduction of teaching to a fairly atomistic collection of technical competencies which can be measured as outcomes. This is antithetical to the synoptic and the synthetic approach that teachers may need to acquire in order to align their teaching and assessment practices to understanding learners, learning, and subject matter. Then as Hargreaves reminds us, to what degree teaching is or could be an art or a science or a combination of the two is a matter of deep dispute amongst teacher educators. Most practitioners in their classrooms will probably think of what they know and able to do as principally an art, one they've acquired over many years, largely alone, through trial and error learning. Few would be able to cite any research evidence except for in the most general terms to warrant what they do, although many educational researchers claim their influence on practicing teachers to be quite real. I asked a large audience of teachers a couple of weeks ago, how many of you could actually cite some research that has actually influenced what you do in the classroom as a teacher, or how you think, or how you work as a teacher? Not one hand went up. So then I said, okay, have a buzz amongst yourselves, come up with what you believe are the characteristics of very effective teaching. So they did that for 10 minutes. I said, now let's share them, let's hear what you've said. Then I showed them some best evidence synthesis statements. I said, now how do your ideas stack up with those? And I was sort of ticking things off, saying, yeah, we said that, we said that, we said that. I said, but they paid $2.5 million to find that out. That aside, I mean, I think research has got a place, quite an important place. It should be valued, but it suggests, it doesn't actually instruct, it suggests what we need to think about. What I say to teachers then is, okay, do you need to actually rethink some of the things on your list as a consequence of deeper study about this? And that's where the learning comes in for teachers. Not just putting down on teachers what research says, do what research says, but rather saying, okay, where are you at? What's your understanding? Now let's see whether we can actually validate your understandings and strengthen your understandings by going to research. So there's a wee tip there for how you might go about your professional learning and development in your schools. A way that empowers teachers' own sense of being in this process. So when I go into schools now, I see next Walt's dripping from ceilings in classrooms, little Disney in it, mainly just Walt, and heaps of next steps. And it's mainly literacy and numeracy, and the literacy is mainly writing and reading and very little oracy, which I'm afraid, from my point of view and my observations, is probably a major priority, especially for kids who are having difficulty in reading and writing. But it's not going to be measured. This is something I like to show time and again because it shows two different perspectives of the quality teaching. Adrian Elton Lee said at a secondary principals conference, she said that teacher professional learning needs to be grounded in an evidence-based approach that uses data about students' learning and research about effective pedagogy to inform teaching practice. Teachers need to see evidence work as their work. So they need to become sort of detective inspector teachers. Evidence work. Okay. Alan Luke, wonderful Chinese-American, brilliant thinker and speaker. He says the ability of the teacher to call upon a repertoire of teaching practice and to weave into teaching and learning was fundamental. I mean, you cannot extrapolate out things like the relationships that you have with students, how the teacher actually determines what expectations are suitable for each child. The perils of being explicit, Walt's next steps and so on. Making explicit what is to be learned and the accompanying success criteria risks falling off the other side of the tightrope. The pull here is towards increasingly detailed learning intentions, next steps, outcomes which specify required achievement and which are announced rather than negotiated. The term learning goals may be preferable since it conveys a sense of both flexibility and breadth. While terms like learning outcomes can be valuable if well used, they are often misappropriated and adopted widely at all levels of an education system, classroom to test-making laboratories, to facilitate the managerial process. This leads to distortions. The proper interpretation of outcomes must be emerged from the context and prevailing activities and experiences of students. I mean, to have this way of thinking means that you need to have a strong sort of philosophical, theoretical view of the whole nature of learning and the purpose of a school. I'm going to read some of my slides quite deliberately. I know you can read, so don't bother putting in the evaluation forms you read out slides that we could have read for ourselves because I quite like reading them myself out loud, okay? This guy here, Bruce Hammond's name is well known in the Taranaki area around New Zealand. I read an article of his recently and I just picked out a few thoughts that he had in there, and I'm not sort of quoting directly from his article, but I thought he is also knocking on this particular issue when he says, has intentional teaching, where teachers predetermine the process and the content to be taught, gone too far? Has best practice really become fixed practice? Has the emphasis on rationality gone too far? Has literacy and numeracy become the evil twins of the curriculum? We're referring to this paper from the UK. Well, what about joy? What about passion, enthusiasm, creativity, originality, curiosity, adventure, and fun? I love going into schools where I can sense that going on, because that is the very first circle I showed you, the learner and engagement. If we're not getting that engagement, we can't be confident that the learning is being maximised. Then there's a matter of leadership. And last year, the New Zealand Principals Federation did a survey on the matters that are of most concern to New Zealand principals, and there are the things that they actually said. Now, nobody there mentioned anything about curriculum and learning, teaching, professional development, all of those sorts of things. Now, herein lies a challenge for you people. Somehow you need to get your job into balance if you are to have a major influence on what happens in learning, because that's what schools are for. It's the only reason the Ministry of Education exists, when you think about it, is to promote, enable, advance children's learning. That is the raison d'etre for education. So principalship, it is being driven into principals that your role is to be curriculum leaders, instructional leaders. That's your job. It's not a very realistic depiction of your job, I'm afraid. In my view, principalship is about both leadership and management. The most effective schools that I've been in have got strong management practice, and it's come from the principal's direction of that school. And it's also got that strong leadership. I mean, somehow it's a bit like having both operating parts. You've got to be a bit of a worm, a hermaphrodite. You've got to have both the management aspect of your direction as well as that leadership. However, for you, it's a matter of saying, well, what sort of allocation or proportions of my time, my focus, my energy is actually attended to both to each of these particular dimensions? Their roles, the roles of leadership and management, or the functions of those, are complementary. One belongs with the other. It's the same in the classroom, really. You go into a teacher who's got poor management, the learning is going to be at jeopardy. We know that. Leadership and management. Let's be quite clear about this. It has got, those two dimensions have got quite distinctive functions. So it's leadership plus management is what principalship is about. Part of this is not just curriculum leadership, but it's about managing the resources, the time, all sorts of things that are actually going to advance or inhibit learning. You've probably already had a session on the model for Kiwi leadership, and because of time I'm not going to dwell on it, but I think it's a very good one. I like it. I think it gives schools, it gives principals a good conceptual view of the interrelationships of the different dimensions of your job. Above all, you need to be multilingual as a leader, working within multiple and competing discourses. For example, managerialism and care, accountability and professional autonomy, competition and collaboration, personal and social education, and so it goes on. So with all due respect to those who run leadership courses and prepare principals for programs, Bennis, I think, quite correctly argues that perhaps more leads will be made by accident, circumstance, and sheer grit than be made by all the leadership courses put together. I'm sorry about that, John. But I noticed, John, that you didn't go to one of these courses when you were a young principal. That is not in any way be disparaging of this. I think you are having a wonderful opportunity to be able to do what you can do. When I was a young principal, I was invited to a course here at Lochtel House out in Titirangi in Wellington, where very few principals got invited, and was titled "The Men and Women Likely to Assume Further and Increasing Responsibility." Well, you know, it was sort of like the lodge, really. You didn't really know how you got into that sort of thing. Success. We know that successful leaders have strong influence, and yet we keep on doing research, even from Auckland up here, to try to find out whether, in fact, principals do have a strong influence. Well, Darling Hammond and these other people, who she's now an advisor to President Obama, and is probably one of the most internationally respected researchers of the world, she's actually said it. I don't think we need to keep on trying to prove it, that principals do actually have an influence on student learning. I don't think there's any point in trying to quantify it and say you actually have a 15% factor, as the teacher has a 25% factor. I'm not quite sure why I'd even bother with that sort of mentality. There's no one package for school leadership, no one model to be learned and applied regardless of culture or context. School leaders do not learn how to do leadership. Good leaders are often rule breakers who are willing to change in response to new circumstances. Are you a rule breaker? How many rules have you broken lately? Which rules? Will they just be tiddly rules? Will they be big rules? What you need as a leader is a belief in yourself, yet a decent doubt as you break those rules, a passion for the job, yet an awareness of other worlds. And you need to have a love for people, yet a capacity for aloneness. Just love that set of, I've lost the, it's from Handy. Of course, there have always been, haven't always been, but there have been courses for principals going on, or leadership courses for going on for quite some time now. And you might ask yourself, what level am I? Because we've sort of got this levels mentality in New Zealand now. Well, at this particular course for principals, levels of leadership, level one was walking on water, whereas level two is treading water, level three, level four, which level are you actually on? Well, as Martin Thrutt from the University of Waikato says, effective leadership and teaching in one local context is just not the same as effective leadership and teaching in another. I know that to be a great truism in New Zealand. We are a very, very diverse country. I had the great privilege of spending a couple of days with the Ngāti Porou principals up in the East Coast there a month or two ago. And, you know, it just keeps coming home to you all the time, this whole socio-cultural thing about what is important and how we do things, and we think differently and we do things differently, and there should not be one set way that we have to be all doing those things. On the matter of curriculum, if you haven't got a good definition or a good understanding of what curriculum is, and if I was had all day here, I'd be getting you now to actually be testing what your definition is with the others, but you can try this back at your schools. What do you mean by curriculum anyway? What is your definitional stance? Is it this straightforward one, as Tarba gives us, it's a plan for learning? Or is it something like this, a contrived activity and experience, organised, focused, systematic, the life unaided would not provide? properly artificial, selecting, organising, elaborating, speeding up processes of real life? Or is a curriculum by definition not a tangible product but the actual day-to-day interactions of students, teachers, knowledge and their environment? Or, at a meeting that I think, Margaret, you were at this meeting in Wellington, we attended one day on the competences or something, and somebody quipped this, and I said, ah, that is the definitive definition of curriculum. That is it. So, if you as a leader, as a principal, want to have a confidence in terms of knowing what goes on in the curriculum in your school, you've got to go inside those rooms. That's the only way that you can have a true depiction in your mind of how curriculum works in your school. I remember when I was a first-year teacher, the principal used to wander around the school and he said, every time I go past so-and-so's room, I think they must be singing the national anthem because the children will stand up. But he never went into the classrooms, he only looked through the windows. What we do know is that curriculum operates at different levels. There is a mandated curriculum, what the state states, and the state is entitled, in a state-funded system, to set its expectations. In a self-managing system, those expectations need to be stated in such a way that allow you sufficient scope for localised interpretation of your curriculum. Then, of course, you cannot assume that because the state states this, that is exactly what happens. Then you've got the implemented curriculum, what the teacher actually does, and then what the student actually learns from all of that. And we all know as teachers that despite our best efforts in the classroom of covering programs, that not all children have actually been attuned into that or learned from it. I remember as an inspector of schools, one of the things we used to do under the O&I regulations, the first part of the ritual was to examine the school's documentation on its curriculum. Then we'd spend the rest of the time visiting classrooms. And what pleased me often greatly was the fact that there was a great inconsistency between what I actually read in the documents and what I saw going on in the classrooms. Think about that. In terms of the experience curriculum, well, I had a parent once who rang me as a principal saying, look, Lester, we're rather concerned and we'd like to come and see you. I knew they're a very sensible, pleasant family, so it wasn't the most stressful sort of meeting. She came up and said, Lester, our children are using a lot of bad language around the house, around home, and that's not something that we actually condone in our place, and it's not something we even model. Our children never hear it at home, so we've come to the conclusion they must be learning it at school. And I said, you're correct. But it's not part of the mandated, the state curriculum, it's not part of the teacher's curriculum, and it's not part of the learning. It's part of the experience curriculum. And then we talked about how now the strength of their own values and so on needed to be able to ride over that. What is the purpose then? What's the background to this curriculum? A lot of people don't really know, and that bothers me, because if we don't know the background to it, we're not empowered, we're not warmed in the tummy about actually getting it going, let alone in the mind. The ministry sent a CD-ROM to school principals outlining what this curriculum is going to be all about. And fortunately, most principals are quite sensible. When they see a CD-ROM from the ministry, they don't put it into their machine. In this particular case, what they showed on the CD-ROM were a rationale for change, the past and the present. So we moved from black and white to colour. But essentially, it is quite dishonest, because what they're suggesting here is we're moving from practices of the 1919s into this type of practice. Then they went on to show this slide here, which is the most bereft of all insights into what schools are really equipped to do. I mean, children do not need teachers, schools, to help them to work out how to make an Xbox go or a cell phone ring this particular way. It has to be something more than that. So where did it all come from? Well, we were told by the Minister of Education at the time, well, we need a curriculum for the 21st century. That's why we've got it. But what does that mean, really? I mean, when I look at young children and I think, what is this world going to be like for them when they reach my age? And I just took this photograph out of the Dominion because I thought it was such a lovely photograph, a family that's doubled overnight with the birth of triplets, and they look such neat kids. And when I look at young children, I often think, what will the world be like? And what are the things that a school can actually do to help the children on that journey towards the school, what the world is going to be like? Now, I've got no idea what the world is going to be like technologically when these kids reach my age. I mean, it just moves so fast. I mean, I have to go to Dick Smith just about every week now to upgrade my tools and things. because it's mainly boys and men who go into Dick Smith's, I've found. But I do know that when these children reach my age, they are going to still need to be literate and numerate. Values are going to be important. Science is going to be important. The arts. I mean, the ancient cavemen indulged in the arts. And they've been part of humanity ever since. They need to go into being in good health. All of those sorts of things are still going to be relevant then as they are now. And it's piffle to say, well, look, you won't need to learn to write because you can just speak to your computer and it will write. And, of course, you can do that now anyway. There's software that allows you to do that. It'll read the novel to you. But how many people really like going to bed on a cold winter's night and opening up their computer to read a novel? Or lying on the beach? It's just not really right, is it? Now, what is the direction then for this curriculum? Well, in 1991, Russell Marshall, the Minister of Education, who had been displaced by then by David Lommy, who decided he'd be Minister of Education, but up until during Russell Marshall's time, he authorised a national review of our school's curriculum. And we had meetings up and down the country. And then there were all sorts of notices and gazettes, statements and excitement about what our curriculum should be. And it said those sorts of things in the gazette. And I said to the ministry, why don't you just reprint that, because that's what you're still saying for this curriculum. What's gone on in the intervening years? Well, I could explain that to you, but there isn't time. But essentially, what happened was we moved from at a system level to a self-managing system, from a Department of Education to a Ministry of Education, to a system where a minister wanted a more accountable curriculum. Lockwood Smith, who's getting married, I see, he wanted a curriculum where people would be more accountable, where there'd be levels and achievement objectives to actually establish what those would be. A whole lot of things have gone on in the last 15 years. But we're really sort of coming right back to the thinking that is not new, because that was the thinking that was rich at that particular point of time. The real reason behind this is a curriculum stocktake. For a number of, right from the beginning of the very first new curriculum document, the maths curriculum, the Maths Teachers Association of New Zealand commissioned Sir Geoffrey Howden, an eminent British maths educator, to come to New Zealand and to do a scholarly critique of this new document. I got a copy in my office, and it is scholarly. And that's where it all started, and it sort of rumbled on ever since, dissatisfaction with the nature of that curriculum and the various interpretations that people have put upon it. And this has never ever been disclosed publicly, but it's good to have moles in the system who pass stuff on to you. During the open forums, these are the concerns that sector groups put on the table at that stocktake about issues with the current, this is the new revised curriculum, with the current piles of curriculum. As a result of this, the Ministry developed the stocktake report and it went up to government with a set of recommendations about what should be done with the curriculum. And here are the four things that they recommended, or they say, the Ministry will say, this is what the government approved, and the government normally approves what its officials recommend it should approve, that four things could happen in the development of this document. The first is to clarify and refine curriculum outcomes. The next one is to focus on quality teaching. The next one is to have a curriculum structure that allows for greater school ownership. Why? Why do we need greater school ownership? Well, there's a magical trick in this. When you have a strong sense of ownership, you have a much stronger sense of commitment, belief, drive, all those sorts of things. Moreover, it more clearly focuses on the particular needs and circumstances of the people in your area. And the final one is to support communication and strengthen partnerships with parents. Now, I've said to the Ministry, why don't you say this is the direction? Take that statement that the government approved. Rationalisation of learning outcomes. In other words, what learning is important in our schools? How much of that learning? There's a major exercise there for investigation in the school, for clarification. Quality teaching. That's where the best evidence synthesis has been holding its own in terms of influence on policy. School ownership. Community engagement. The team up. The Tama Umanga advertisements. Who's seen them on television? About the third last gazette was featuring this whole matter of community engagement. Why? because it's widely known and understood that if parents, families, whānau, communities are not providing children with a lifestyle and upbringing that fits them well for learning, their learning is always going to be in jeopardy. If children don't get a decent night's sleep, if they're not on regular sets of expectations, all those sorts of things, without going into it in detail. In the Gazette, that was the 23rd of March, children are more likely to do well at school when their parents, families and whānau hold high expectations and play an active part in their learning. Now that's hardly rocket science, we know that. However, it goes on to say that is not only common sense, but something borne out by the New Zealand research. So, you know, our common sense is fine, but we need to research just to make sure we're correct on that one. What are our obligations under this? Well, it's a bit of a yin and a yang. Yin and yang means taking harmony out of, you know, sometimes two competing forces or two different forces, two different localities, the older and the newer, and so on and so on and so on. So a lot of stuff that's being done in the schools in this country, in many schools, that is very, very good, that has been going on for some time. This is not a time to have to throw it all out. Far from it. There's experience and inexperience. I've met some relatively inexperienced principals who bring some quite fascinating dimensions to their thinking. They're not sort of shut up in a black box. And likewise with some curriculum leaders. You've read those sorts of things. I mean, what's this got to do with it? Well, I thought this was quite funny when I went into the classroom and saw this the blackboard, which could have been the same blackboard in 1970 alongside that. What's it got to do with the presentation? My argument is that if nothing much begins to happen or to change in curriculum and assessment practice, then this whole thing is a waste of time and money. It's just more hot air. The challenge is really pretty much in your hands as leaders. The Education Review Office has done a progress report on schools' readiness to implement this curriculum. And they did this in terms 3 and 4 last year, and I believe they're continuing on. And they asked schools those sorts of questions, sort of a multiple choice test. Overall readiness to implement, not yet preparing, some preparation well underway, well prepared. And we heard of a story at this ministry meeting the other day of a secondary school in the greater Auckland area that hasn't actually opened the boxes yet. They must be pretty proud of their current curriculum. Now, on this top line of the months that are sort of ticking away, we're now into April, and in 2010 this becomes the document. They've got graphs in their report. You can download this and have a look at it if you're fascinated. Which compare primary and secondary. But the main thing that concerned me about the Education Review Office's report was the assumption that schools, or the view that schools should be ready to implement February 2010. You pull a big lever, and this lever sort of ejects all of the current ones and it brings these in. But not only that, it's all happening. All the key competencies are being infused into your curriculum and so on and so on and so on. This concerned us quite a lot at the advisory meeting with the ministry recently, to the point that it has been decided that somebody needs to go along and speak to the Education Review Office and say, hey, we don't want the whole development, the richness, the deeper learning that's necessary for this to be subverted by precipitous expectations that schools will be doing it by the beginning of next year. Already that ERO claims to identify schools that are now fully ready to implement. Well, I wonder. I'd like to go back and inspect those schools. Curriculum literacy. Well, I've got 10 minutes left. Essentially what I do with this is, and I've got these actually as a handout, I've got about 100, John, so you might want to photocopy some more, is my belief is that unless principals and teachers can carry stuff, or certain stuff around in their heads, they can't enter into a sort of an interactive discourse, or whatever you want to call it, with your colleagues. So I give tests. I say, okay, name the 5 key competencies. Tell the person next to you. Then I say, put up your hand if you've got 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And the hands, more hands are going up now, but principals tend to get the lower scores, I have found. How can you go around interacting and talking about your stuff if you've not got just the key words floating around your head? How can you start to develop the conceptual thinking that sits behind them? So there are these, and I say, well, okay, what are the seven values? Not too many people actually can get those. In fact, I've never seen a hand go up in the many, many audiences I've spoken to in New Zealand, and that tells you something else about those. Not everybody sort of thinks that things like ecological sustainability trips off their tongue as a value. Then you've got the learning areas, and everybody says, oh, yes, we know the learning areas. And I say, but wait on, you just tell me what science education is about. Tell the person next to you what science education is about. Then I hold up I read out the statements that are in here, the essence statements, and I say, okay, was your statement fairly consistent with what I've read out from the essence statement in here? Not too many hands go up. Then I read out another statement about science. I say, well, how many people's idea of good science education was reasonably consistent with this one? And quite a few hands start to go up. Why? Because I've actually stuck the draft one from the draft curriculum onto my copy because I think they're better than this one in here. Why? Because as a committee, yes, it works. See, and committees keep on fiddling around with things when they've got more and more time. But what I'm really trying to say is, if you can't tell somebody what a science education is all about in a summary way, or what arts education is all about, are you really equipped as a professional? Have you got have you really got even a fundamental level of curriculum literacy? Do you want to test yourselves on this now? Write them down and pass them into me and I'll give you marks back through John tomorrow. We can't have this level of curriculum fluency if we don't have these things. Now that takes time. Primary school teachers are general practitioners. They've got the whole lot to come to grips with. Secondary school teachers say, oh, I just teach science. Not in my secondary school. Hey, wait on. We've all got to have an appreciation of what the arts is about. We've all got to have an appreciation of this because we're educating the whole child in this school. We need to be able to enter into discussions with our colleagues. See, there's a lot of learning that's needed. And you need to do that. That learning takes time. So, and then around that we've got the values and the principles. So there are only 31 big things to remember. So what I say to people is, when I give you the copy of that particular thing to take away, most schools, their laminators run hot. Take this away, laminate it as soon as you get back to school, take it home, use it as a placemat. When you're sort of drooling over it, you can wipe it clean again and keep going back. You can't sleep at night, have it beside your bed so that you've really got those things up in your mind. I mean, we are all capable of learning, and sometimes we've just got to exercise that bit of discipline. What are the requirements of the curriculum? These are on page 44. And on page 44, I'll tell you how these got in here. It's unusual to set out the requirements in the document. Where do we normally state requirements of schools in New Zealand for curriculum? Where are they normally stated? This is your chance for interaction. The National Administration Guidelines. Now, at one of our meetings of the National Reference Group that oversaw the development of this, the manager of the National Administration Guidelines came along to speak to us, and he said, now that we've got a new national curriculum on the way, we will have to change the National Administration Guidelines. Oh, he didn't say as fast as that because he's more cognitively sort of delayed. And I'm sitting there thinking, why on earth would you need to change those guidelines? I know them pretty intimately, what those guidelines say. They're very consistent with self-management. They're very consistent with what this document's about. Admittedly, they don't use the word values and key competencies and vision and so on, but they still can be accommodated within that. So there has been a bit of a worry about the subversion of what the intentions were behind all this from the developers. So we thought we should put the requirements into the document. And that will perhaps overcome or preempt nags. But next term, you're going to be getting, in consultation form, I believe, revised National Administration Guidelines. Look very carefully. I've given notice to the Ministry. I've said, if those National Administration Guidelines start to undermine the spirit of what's in here, I said, I think every school in New Zealand should send these back to you. And I said, I'll lead the campaign. Because it's just been another whole waste of time and trickery and so on going on. Now, what it says in here is that your curriculum should be underpinned by and consistent with the principles. That is a requirement. So therefore, because when these principles were being developed, it was being said, these aren't just to be a statement of blah at the beginning of the document. These are to be lived in the practice of the school. So an effective school review will want to say, okay, Can you demonstrate how these principles, how can we see these principles being enacted in your school? Now, there's the first challenge. What do those principles mean? And they do require some unwrapping. If I had time, I'd go through a methodology which I've been advocating, which I call evidence in practice. Got to get away from this evidence on paper, endless paper, setting out what you're doing and proving what you're doing. The most powerful evidence, the evidence that resonates into students and their learning and teaching and their practice, is what goes on in the school. So come along and have a look with me, Education Review Officer, parent, Board of Trustees, colleagues, and we will show you how the principle of high expectations is demonstrated in our school. We can talk about it as teachers. So we've got to develop that level of fluency. The next legal requirement currently is concerns of values. It doesn't say you'll teach the values. You can't teach values. That was Jenny Shipley's idea. Okay? You know where she is now. Working up here in Auckland. I saw her the other day with red lipstick and red fingernails and so on. Don't know what she's doing up here, but anyway, the values are to be encouraged, modelled and explored. That's the teacher's role. Some of the schools that I'm working with, for them, this has almost become catechetical. How many Catholics in the room? Catechetical. They can recite those words to me. I say, what is your role with the values? And they say, our role, Lester, is to encourage, model, and explore the values. They can just talk about it. It's up there. That sets a whole frame for their action. And then the next one that says that support students to develop the key competencies. That is the alpha and the omega of the requirements. Nowhere does it say that you'll assess them. Nowhere does it say you'll assess the key competencies. Talking with some senior people in the ministry, I think they've got a vision. It's not my vision. This is a myopic vision. That one day, yes, we might be expecting schools to assess them. There are all sorts of pitfalls in assessing the key competencies. However, in my model of the key competencies, I've actually divided them into two major sections. Two of them, I say, are the cognitive, intellectual sort of domains, and the other, what I call the relational, that's managing self, relating to others, and communicating, participating and contributing. It seems to me that your role is to be able to demonstrate that you are supporting students to develop the key competencies. So there's a wee bit of a sting in the tail here. How are we going to demonstrate this? And some schools are doing wonderful things. I've been to a school in Kerikeri where this assistant principal says, we're not having this written stuff, come and see. We'll show you how we're developing the key competencies. It's all there for you to see in their action and their literacy programs and so on and so on and so on. They've got a whole culture of language and process that is at work there. If there is to be any assessment, especially for the relational key competencies, like the managing self, the relating to others, it should be centrally the student who's doing that work. And we're not very good at that. We've used smiley faces and tick boxes and so on, which is pretty feeble sort of self-assessment, really. We need to discover, explore better ways to help kids to make determinations about where they're at with those key competencies. Well, my time is up. So the walrus said, so I'll now flick down to the first hour of the 5 hours I've prepared for you. So I'll come to some conclusions. You can come to the full movie sometime. I'm getting better at this. Thought I was. I might need help here. This is when people you normally rush up to the front. How do I make that now into a big picture? This one? To conclude, he who looks outside dreams. He who looks inside awakens. We have to think about ourselves, what we believe about learning, and what the substance and the process of learning is all about. I think the good principal is one who looks outside and inside. There is no holy grail. Don't waste your time trying to find it. There's no one best way that's going to work in every school or that's going to reach perfection. The thicker the plan that you develop in your school, the less it's going to affect classroom practice. And the time taken for this, remember, leadership, management, is time taken from that, That's one of my greatest insights I've developed over my career. You can quote me on that. Education's awash with experts and gurus. There are ideagogues, bureaugogues, erodagogues, theoriagogues, academiagogues, but sensibility rests mainly with pedagogues. Schools ain't what they used to be, and they never were. This is what George Albano says, and I love the statement, and I read it many, many times to audiences of principals in New Zealand. He says, success comes down to hard work, great and dedicated teachers, a thoughtful approach to testing, an integrated curriculum, lots of art, music and physical education, yeah, it's sounding good, the willingness to bend and break rules as often as you like, and complete refusal to let any child fail to learn. What a lovely statement. I wish that I'd been clever enough to write that. So let's all put our heads together to do what works best for children. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa.